Cinema with your hosts, Reverend Phantom and T.L. Bug.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to podcast number 2 from Sinful Cinema. I am Reverend Phantom, and as always, I'm joined by T.L. Bug.
Good evening, everybody.
All right. Well, so far, so good as far as the podcast goes. We've got a lot of subscribers for just based on just our one that was actually kind of sloppy.
Yeah, we thank everybody for taking the time to listen. We hope this week's show is going to be somewhat of an improvement. And we hope that you'll keep listening to us. We've gotten some good feedback, and we thank everybody who downloaded the show or streamed it or left a comment on one of our blogs or whatever.
Yeah, we're actually going to try on this one.
Yeah, we are, which is kind of going to be different. Don't expect it in the future. Right. We're not saying we're going to try every week, but this time, we really mean it.
So if you don't like us, if you still don't like us after the second podcast, you're probably not going to like us at all after that, because we're actually trying this time.
So. Yeah, we're trying, and you know, this is the best we can do. Yeah.
All right, you want to jump right into
it? Yeah, let's get into it. What are we going to talk about this week?
Well, first up on the table is, we got a Nightmare on Elm Street remake.
We do.
Coming out.
Not too long.
Yeah, pretty soon, actually. And, well, before we jump into that, I just thought we'd take a look at the Nightmare on Elm Street films leading up to this newest remake.
Well, there's only been like 112 of them, so I think we can run them down real quick here and let everybody know what we think.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious on the first one. Probably shouldn't need to spend too much time on that one. Obviously, it's a classic.
A classic piece of shit. No, I'm just kidding. It is really good. Wes Craven came out and hit one out of the park right off the bat.
Yeah, a rare hit.
Yeah, yeah. Usually he's swing for a miss.
He's got a lot. He hits a lot of fouls.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of fouls in there.
Sports metaphors.
Oh yes, we love them because today's, you know, Super Bowl Sunday, and as you can tell, the Rev and I are big sports fans sitting here recording a horror podcast.
Talking about baseball.
Yes, indeed. We're not even on the right sport, but whatever. It is what it is.
Okay, so the first one, it's a great, great, great horror flick. It's a piece of my youth. It got me into horror. It's just one of those. It's. So, okay, no, let's not spend a lot of time on that.
No, everybody knows. Part 2. Well, part two. Now, here we start having problems.
Freddy's Revenge.
Yeah, Freddy's really strange revenge.
Now, when I saw this as a kid, I did not catch the gay metaphors.
No.
That was until I got a little older and I decided to watch it again. And I was like, wow, this is really gay.
Yeah, it is kind of amazing to look back at it. And, you know, I've tried to, like, step back from it and go, maybe if I watch it and don't think about how gay it is, then it won't seem gay at all. That didn't work.
But I will have to say that I don't hate it.
No.
Yeah, it's got its moments. Now, one of the things that people complain about with that beyond the gay stuff is that Freddy comes out of the dream world.
Right. But, I mean, it's not going to be the last time we see that.
No, and I actually thought that was probably the best part of the movie. You're all my children now.
Yeah, it's a good part of the movie, and the special effects sequence when he pops out the dude's body is quite good.
Yes. Okay, let's. So, where would we rate part two? Kind of middle of the road? I mean, is it?
You know, it's one you got to see because I mean, it's still good. But it's just, it's not up to the first one, and it definitely takes kind of a hard right from where the first one was going. But it's okay, because we're about to get into part 3, which takes a hard left.
My favorite.
Yes, mine too.
Part 3. I think it's a lot of people's favorite.
Yeah, it's just silly.
And it's got Dokken in the soundtrack.
Yeah, it's a lot of silly good fun, and it definitely starts at Dokken and goes from there.
Yep. It's kind of a tie between the first one and that one, I'd say, which are the best of the franchise. But yeah, that's definitely... I like the kills in that one. They're very imaginative. Yeah. Very creative.
Sure, and, you know, it gave us immortal lines like, "Welcome to primetime, bitch." Which, you know, who doesn't want that?
Certainly. And even though I think that worked in Part 3, that was the beginning of where Funny Freddy started to come out and kind of drag some of the ones after that down a little bit.
It did. It definitely was going off the rails there, and it was going to kind of go further off the rails as it went.
Part 4, the Dream Master.
Yeah, we're mastering dreams. Yeah, I don't like this one at all.
Yeah, that's... I'm trying to think of something positive. Nope.
No. It's a movie. It is a length. You could watch it. I don't know why you would.
Moving on. Part 5, The Dream Child.
Less bad. A lot of stuff about Freddy's background and, you know, his origins and stuff like that, so that's kind of cool, but overall, you know, more Funny Freddy, and, you know, I think that's... Is that the one with the pizza? And Freddy's, like, in the pizza? I don't know.
I want to say yes.
I'm not sure. I think it is, though.
It has been... Probably Part 5 is the one I saw when it originally came out, and I don't know if I've checked it out too many times after that.
Yeah, I don't know how long it's been since I've seen it, but it's been a while.
Okay, well, Freddy's dead.
Freddy's dead. Somehow I doubt it, though. I don't care what the film or Curtis Mayfield say. This dude is not dead. He's going to come back. He's going to be in another movie. It's going to be really anticlimactic when they kill him. And guess what? It was.
This one did have the 3D for the, like, last, what, 15 minutes or something like that?
Yeah, something like that, which, you know, they needed something to get butts in seats. I'm not sure how successful that was, but, you know, I'm sure it got a good many people in the theaters.
It got me in the theater. I saw it in the theater. And I had the 3D glasses for a long time. Mm. But yeah, I think that film has a few moments, but not enough to hold the whole film together.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely so. It just, it's not very memorable. It's part of the problem with it. There's just not much to it to really latch onto and be like, oh yeah, remember that great part? Because there just weren't many great parts.
And not that I'm comparing it to the 3D that's out now that is pretty amazing. The 3D, even then, was pretty shitty.
Yeah, it was. We're not talking about, you know, Captain EO here or something fancy like that from the 80s. You know, we're talking about, you know, the blue and the red glasses. And yeah, right. Just not all that good.
And what made it worse is that it wasn't through the whole film, so you're, like, waiting for it. You're like, oh, this is going to be so cool. And then it was like... No, yeah. I was like a preteen or something like that, so it should have really amazed me, and it didn't, so. Mm. Okay, New Nightmare.
I really don't think I remember that one at all.
I did not see it until up to like 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. I remember when it came out just thinking, that's stupid, and I just avoided it altogether.
I seem to vaguely remember seeing it at some time. But it must have left so little impression on me that I don't recall a damn thing about it. I think that was the one where it was like they were making the movie, but Freddy was real and right. You know, bullcrap.
Yeah, I caught it, like I said, a few years ago, and it's I would probably say it's the worst of the whole series.
You know, I can see, kind of understand what, you know, Craven might have been trying, returning, going with the whole kind of meta idea. but
right, it's actually a good idea. So how it went so horribly wrong, I don't know.
Probably Wes Craven. I would chance to make a guess. I mean, dude just does not have a stellar track record, as we've already mentioned.
Craven.
Yes, he might have a scary name, but a lot of his movies are scary in the wrong way.
Freddy versus Jason.
You know, I actually kind of like this one. I watched it recently, and it is so stupid that I'm just so entertained by it, and I kind of feel bad about how entertained I am by it, but it's just incredible amounts of fun. I really like it.
I think if you look at it from that standpoint, then I can understand that. And I don't dislike the film. The first time I saw it, I actually fell asleep.
Wow.
in the middle of it. But then I gave it another try, just assuming, okay, that was just me. I was tired. And I watched it again. And I looked at it from a different point of view. And it was kind of where you were coming from there. Sometimes you just can't take these things so seriously. I know people get really wrapped up in, especially the franchise movies, because they're so close to the character of Freddy, or you know, especially in with Halloween and Friday the 13th, that they just like, they have this set way that it's supposed to be in their head. But, you know, if you can step back and look at it from that kind of, more like, you know, it's just goofy, fun, B-movie stuff, and if you can enjoy it on that level, then I think it accomplished what it was set out to do.
Yeah, I mean, it really hits this like kind of camp factor to me that really makes me enjoy it. I actually like Freddy's one-liners in this one. I enjoy, you know, that Jason's just wandering around doing whatever Freddy is tricking him into doing, and the ending is so ludicrous. And that is so much fun to finally see them get to throw down. It was worth seeing the movie, no matter how bad it might have been.
I still think Freddy versus Jason versus Ash will be the one that should have got made, or should still get made.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's really what the fans wanted, but I think we're probably not ever going to get that now. It's just going to be something that we'll all just get a little wet in our panties thinking about.
Especially because, you know, Campbell's getting a little old, and he's probably never going to do the Ash character again.
Yeah, he's a little long in the tooth, and now they've, you know, booted England out of the role. So, you know, the interplay between England and Campbell would have been great. I mean, those two hams chewing up the screen, I don't know how it could get much better. But now that England's not in the role, and Campbell's a little too old, you know, it's just probably not going to happen. But I guess that brings us full circle back around to the present day.
Yes. Now, speaking of, you know, actors getting replaced, now, if Evil Dead is remade, or a fourth one comes along, and it's not Bruce Campbell, I don't want to see it.
It's going to be Ryan Reynolds. You know it will. Come on, his dashing good looks. I mean, it's just, that's how it's got to be.
I'm not saying I can't see, I'm not saying that that's not how it's going to be, but it's, okay, well, what I'm getting at here is, now, I kind of thought the same thing about England with the Freddy character, but Jackie Earl Haley's pretty good.
He is. I mean, a couple of years ago, he came back with Little Children, which is an interesting little non-genre flick. He plays a child molester who's been released from jail. He's in a neighborhood and kind of getting harassed, even though he's paid his dues and trying to live a good life now and whatnot. And it was a really daring kind of role. And then following that up with, you know, The Watchmen. I mean, I don't know that there was anybody else that could have done Rorschach and done him justice like Jackie Earle.
No, and isn't he going to be in Shutter Island?
Yeah, he is one of the inmates in Shutter Island. You can see him briefly in the trailer for a second. I think he's a great, great actor. They've actually been talking a little bit about casting him in DC Comics version of Green Lantern as Sinestro.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think that might be pretty good, too. But he's getting a lot of kind of high-profile baddie roles, so maybe too many might not be such a good thing. But I'm really looking forward to seeing what he does with Freddy Krueger.
Well, here's why I'm not leery, too leery about him becoming Freddy. When the remake was announced, and it was, because at first it was like, is England going to do it? Is he not? Then finally they said, no, he's not going to be in it. And I was like, well, fuck it then. I don't want to see it. I don't want to see it. I don't care. And then they said, who is going to be Freddy? Then I was kind of like, huh. Okay. Because I could see it. I could actually see it. And I was like, well shit.
Yeah, I take it back. I'm sorry. I didn't mean it. Let me see the movie.
There's some issues about how he looks in the film now, like more of a realistic burn victim.
Right. I mean, here's the thing. Remakes are a touchy thing, but the best thing, the best remakes always take the original idea, mm-hmm. kind of remold it, recast it, and produce something that's familiar, but takes it in a different direction. And I think that's what, you know, we're even getting with the different look for Freddy Krueger. It's still familiar. He's still got the mm-hmm. sweater and the hat and mm-hmm. the glove. It's not like he's, you know, wearing a spandex jumpsuit and, you know, having three gloves instead of two.
oh, where would he put the third?
I don't know, but little.
That's a different movie.
Yeah, that is a different movie indeed. I know a couple of websites that might be interested in that movie. Scary. Yeah, I mean, at least it's not that. I mean, it's just going to be, you know, a different look to it. And I think people are going, there's going to be a certain amount of, oh, I don't want that. That's not what I remember. But, you know, what is?
Right. And I think what you pointed out there as far as the gloves there, the hat, the Christmas sweater, it's all there. Arguing about the makeup is kind of petty to me.
Yeah,
it's
I
like
agree.
He's still a burnt up guy, so it's like it's not Robert Englund, first of all. So it's not even if they went with the same kind of makeup design on the face, it still wouldn't look like Freddy,
right?
Because Haley's got a different, or Earl Haley's got a different face.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So. It's not like, you know, Myers or Jason, and it's just a guy in a mask. Freddy's got a lot of personality, not just in his voice, but just in his facial expressions and everything.
So. Right. I think that's why people take a lot more readily to Friday the 13th remakes or, you know, additional Halloweens, although we talked last week about how well that usually goes. But, you know, nobody really cares, you know, if it's, you know, who it is behind those things. It's just some big, massive, steroid-infused stunt guy, usually. And, you know, it doesn't really matter, because they have personality, but only in their kind of, like, ways of killing and things like that. They don't have, like, you know, like, Freddy Krueger is an individual, whereas, like, Michael or Jason is more akin to, like, a zombie or something like that. It's more of a shell.
And not to get off track here, but that's kind of the way I felt about the Last House on the Left remake.
I have not seen that yet.
I haven't seen it. I've seen parts of it. I really don't have a whole lot of interest in the film, and I'm not trying to knock it anyway, because I've heard some people say it's actually kind of good.
Yeah, me too.
But the Krug character is. It's kind of the same thing with me with the Freddy thing, is that Hess just owns that character.
Yeah.
I was like, I really wish they hadn't renamed it, because I believe the guy in the new one is named Krug as well.
Yeah, I believe so.
So, it's kind of the same thing. It's like, it's not a guy behind a mask. It's this guy that's, it's everything about him. It's his facial expressions. The way he delivers his lines and everything. So it's... It's just one of those things.
Yeah, I mean, it's gonna be a tough thing getting people over the differences in a remake, but remakes are gonna happen, I think this one might be a solid one, and, you know, we don't have that long to go, just a couple more months until we find out.
Now, I know I've been, you know, let down before, but the trailer, I think the trailer looks pretty solid.
I was pretty excited the first time I saw the trailer. I was pretty impressed, and I thought that it struck that same kind of dark, shadowy look that Wes Craven used in the original movie. Which is what really makes that one the strongest for me. Like, so much of Freddy as the boogeyman and him lurking in the shadows of the dream world and whatnot was really what always set me on edge when I watched that movie, because you could just... They used the reveal real late in the movie, so you could just always sort of almost make out what he looked like.
Right. That's... Yeah, kind of what we left out on the first one there is that the first one is actually the only one to me that is actually, I'm not gonna say, obviously when I was a kid I thought it was pretty creepy and scary, you know, obviously I don't actually feel that way now, but I remember seeing it for the first time just being creeped out when he's in the alleyway and the arms are getting all long and he's scratching along the walls and the sound of his voice and everything, and it everything works so well in the first one.
Right. I mean, it remains to be seen whether this guy can, what's his name? Samuel Bayer. Apparently he's done music videos primarily. It remains to be seen whether he can pull it off. But, you know, if he does pull it off, then, you know, maybe there's somebody new out there in the horror world to pay attention to.
Hopefully. That'd be nice.
Yeah, it would be.
Things are getting so bleak.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are a few bright spots here and there, and hopefully this will be one of them. It looks like we're waiting for April 16th for this to come out, so we've got a little while, and, you know, we'd like to know what y'all think, too, so, you know, feel free to drop us a line. We've got an email address now. You can drop us a line at sinfulcinema@charter.net, and let us know what you think, and we'll read out your emails on the show.
All right, let's go ahead and move on. First movie up tonight that we're taking a look at is The Sentinel from 1977. We're doing a movie from the year I was born and a movie from the year you were born tonight.
That's correct.
Okay, so from 1977, The Sentinel.
I call thee! They heard confusion, expedite our glory.
Is the Sentinel the only thing that stands between the mortal world and the torment of hell? Between happiness and horror?
She went to a party with 8 dead murderers.
Eli Wallach.
Doesn't everybody?
I've had a noisemaker.
Sylvia Miles.
Nobody has lived in that building for 3 years.
Ava Gardner, Martin Balsam, Jose Ferrer, Arthur Kennedy.
There is danger.
I swear to God, I'll kill you!
Chris Sarandon.
I'll kill you!
Burgess Meredith.
Welcome home.
And Christina Raines, The Sentinel. The most frightening motion picture experience of your life. And the most revealing. Turn around. Look behind you.
Be one with us.
No!
There is evil everywhere. And the Sentinel is the only hope. The Sentinel.
All right. So, Sentinel, basically, a story of a fashion model moves into a house that's inhabited on the top floor by a blind priest, played by John Carradine. She begins having strange physical problems, having trouble sleeping at night, and has some nasty flashbacks of her attempted suicide when she was a teenager. She complains to the real estate agent of the noise caused by the strange neighbors, and find out that the house is only occupied by the priest and no one else. And she ultimately discovers that she has been put in the house for a reason.
What reason would that be, I wonder? Well, that's a spoiler.
Yeah.
So you won't hear that.
No spoilers. No.
But plenty of talking about this movie, because I really like this movie.
Yeah, this I hadn't seen it in probably over 10 years, somewhere in the late 90s, after seeing it several times as a kid. But yeah, I was still pleased with it. It wasn't one of those didn't let me down like so many lovely memories from my childhood than to watch me again and go, oh my god, that sucked.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, this is one, I've only seen this in the last couple of years. I wish I'd seen this as a kid, because this one puts me on edge now. There's something like very atmospheric and creepy about it, like all her weird ass neighbors, mm-hmm. Who are just a cast of characters that you know, we'll have to get into because they are great.
Yeah, first we probably this the cast.
Oh,
I was freaking amazed. I was like, "Oh, he's in this or she's in this?"
I know, it's like almost everybody in the cast. As you go down the IMDb, it's like, "I know them, I know them, I know them, I know them." I mean, there's very few movies that are cast quite this well.
Yeah, we got Chris Sarandon from Fright Night and Princess Bride, Dog Day Afternoon,
with an amazing porn stash. I mean, this thing, it is large and in charge, and he is like, his lawyer character is always like dressed to the nines and doing magic tricks, and it's quite a character for Mr. Sarandon.
You know, you mentioned Franco Nero's mustache last week.
Yes.
You got a thing with mustaches?
I do. I have a thing with mustaches. I mean, what can you do? Facial hair is freaking awesome. And
Can you grow a mustache?
I do. I indeed sport a mustache and a thin goatee.
Okay, because I thought for a second that you might have some mustache jealousy,
no,
a little bit
no.
of mustache envy.
No, I don't have any mustache envy. I myself sport quite the stash myself. So I just like to see the other mustachioed out there in the world.
Yeah.
And 70s film is just full of it.
Let's say, who else we got? Like I mentioned, John Carradine.
Yep.
With Eli Wallach.
Yeah, no kidding. Showing up accompanied by Christopher Walken, who just stands around and looks creepy.
I'm pretty sure he doesn't even have a line.
And no, he does. Did he have speak? One. He has one line, 13 words. I counted them. and that is his only line. And my favorite thing is, as the movie begins, it goes, "Introducing Christopher Walken."
Right.
With one line. But yeah, Wallach and Walken are great. Loved seeing them in there.
Burgess Meredith.
Oh, now there's a guy. A lot of people know Burgess Meredith as the Penguin from Batman or from the Rocky movies.
Yep.
And in this one.
Rocky!
Yeah, no, yeah, give it to him.
yeah, bum!
Yeah, so. You know, he's great. He reminds me of, like, Truman Capote's, like, slightly butcher brother.
Now, what I would, not to give anything away, but I really think they should have let him go off a little more in this film, because there was something really creepy about him in this film, his character, that and it gets even more creepier as the film goes on.
No doubt.
But I was waiting for just, like, a little bit more evil to come out, but it kind of never kind of fully went there. But
no, but I mean, he definitely brings the just, he's just such a little weirdo, and he's really fun to watch. It's a really good performance to just sit back and watch and see him perform, because sometimes he does go a little too far over the top in some of his later roles. Mm-hmm. But I don't think this one was one of the times. I think he actually kept it fairly restrained, and yeah, you're right. It could have used maybe a little bit more.
Who else? We had Jerry Orbach,
yeah,
from Law and Order,
and Daddy from Dirty Dancing, because
yes.
No one puts baby in a corner.
Jeff Goldblum,
yep, for as a photographer showing up. Ava Gardner.
Yep. Beverly D'Angelo.
Dude. Oh, all right. So Beverly D'Angelo, we got to talk about this for a second. So Miss D'Angelo and Sylvia Miles are a couple that live downstairs. A couple of, it seems to be dancers, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to be quite intimate with each other. And when Allison Parker is visiting them, Miss D'Angelo's character does not seem like she does not mind flicking the bean when there's company in the room.
She rubs one out right there in front of
her. Wow, it is something to behold. If you've never watched Beverly D'Angelo simulate masturbation on film, now is your chance.
But it's such an awkward scene. You almost feel... What's the lead actress's name?
Reigns, Christina Reigns.
Yeah, you almost feel you're in the scene with her, and you're like, okay, what are you doing?
No doubt, it is like it was pretty effective way to heighten tension, because it's just like it puts you like going like, what if I was there and somebody just started doing that? That would be weird. They're like, what if I went over to my buddy's house? He was just like, hey, how's it going? Just whipped it out and started going to town. I'm not sure I'd feel right about that.
Yeah. That was a good scene. The scene where she walks in on her dad and he's boning two chicks.
Yeah, that was another, and there's cake involved and feathers and all kind of weird stuff going on there.
And it's a very ugly menage.
It is a menage of nasty. It is not a good-looking group of people at all.
I think I might have ran and tried to kill myself, too, because that's what she does after she sees that.
Yeah, that would definitely be something I would consider quite soon.
Let's see, what else?
Well, I think we forgot to mention this movie's from Michael Winner.
Right.
And Michael Winner...
Death Wish.
Death Wish, and Death Wish 2, and Death Wish 3, where Death Wish went crazy.
Yeah, so, I mean, he's got credentials there. I believe he did some other Charles Bronson flicks, too.
He did. He did The Mechanic. He did Shadows Land. Several other ones. What he didn't do is much other horror.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is too bad, because I think he really did a good job on this one. And really brought something to the table. Because it's, I mean, in a way, it's a supernatural story. It's a religious story. It's kind of taking cues from a little bit of The Exorcist, but not without, you know, it doesn't hit that nail on the head like so many Exorcist clones do. And I think that's what really made this movie good, because it was a similar feel, but something definitely wildly different.
Yeah, that's probably one of the better things about the film, is that it is something different. There's not a whole lot of horror movie cliches in the film. There's a few, but I mean nothing that's like, oh, I know what's going to happen next kind of a thing.
Right. And one of the things Winter did, though, that I think was one of the creepiest things in the movie, was bring in real freaks for one of the climactic scenes in the film.
Yeah, that's what I want to talk about. That.
Yeah, me too. Because nothing, you know, freaks, you know, sideshow attraction people, you know, we know that, you know, in modern times it's looked down upon to, you know, see them as a curiosity or whatever, but there definitely was a time for that, and in the 70s was definitely still that time.
Let me tell you, one of the scariest movies... Well, one of the movies that scared me the most, and you know, I even still to this day don't like to watch it, is The Elephant Man.
Yeah, that movie is quite creepy.
It scared the shit out of me as a kid. I mean, I thought The Elephant Man was in my closet.
Yeah, I know what you mean, and Todd Browning's Freaks is not really all that much better either.
Those two movies, man, more than any Freddy's or Jason's... Those movies. And it's almost sad to say, because The Elephant Man is actually, as I saw it as an adult, was a really sad movie and really well made film and all that, but you know, not a horror movie at all. But goddamn, just the special effects, the makeup effects in that movie just got right to me, man. And it stuck with me. And like I said, I still like I've caught it like on TV, and I'll just keep flipping past it.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I have to be in a certain kind of mood to want to watch Freaks. Because it's, you know, sometimes just it's not going to be conducive to the rest of my day.
When the first one pops up in this film, it's a jolt. It's like, oh shit.
It is, because there's not been anything quite that viscerally in your face for any of this film. I mean, a lot of it's quite, you know, it's a slow burn, and it's very steady, and it's very atmospheric and creepy, and suddenly there are just loads of weird people all over.
Oh yeah, and he finds some serious ones there. That's
yeah, no doubt. And it, but it is one of the strongest parts of the film, and really adds to the whole ending.
Yeah, the other part of the film, the one that actually made the Bravo's 100 Scariest Moments in Horror. Did you catch that?
I think I did some years back, but I don't remember which scene was on there.
It's the scene where she's exploring upstairs and she goes into that other apartment and there's I won't give anything away. There's a person behind the door and it just kind of walks through the room.
Yes, that scene. That scene is very good. I love that scene. One of the reasons I love that is it so strikingly seems like an Italian picture for a minute.
Yes.
It just seems like it could be called directly from like Fulci's catalog or something like that and dropped into this movie.
That, I'm probably giving something away here, but that's when we talked yesterday and we were talking about watching these films and I'm like, yeah, I'm about to watch Suspiria. And I meant The Sentinel. That's the perfect example of that. That's kind of in my head where I was at, because that's the kind of it. It seems like an Italian film a little bit.
It does. I mean, you could easily see the same script, you know, in Fulci's hands as one of the Gates films or something like that, because it definitely has that same kind of dread feeling that you get from, like, City of the Living Dead and House by the Cemetery. It's just got that just permeable, like, something's just wrong, and now stuff's going to be gross.
It's the one thing that differs from the Italian films, and it is that it's a pretty linear kind of film. It's not ultra surreal, even though there is some supernatural stuff going on there. It's pretty straightforward.
There are some surreal moments. I really enjoyed her dream sequence when she has a nightmare about going to a party that was a birthday party for a cat.
Yes.
That whole reimagining of the birthday party that you've just seen as a nightmare is very stunning and very well done.
Fellini-esque.
Indeed, it definitely was Fellini-esque in a way.
She's Beverly D'Angelo's clapping the big cymbals.
Yes, while naked, of course.
Oh yes.
Because why bother? You know, if you're going to play cymbals, play them nude.
I brought up the Bravo's 100 Scary Moments. Let's play a little clip from that.
Yeah, let's take a listen.
Nobody has lived in that building for 3 years.
A supermodel moves into a brand new brownstone apartment that is a portal to hell.
Oh yeah.
There is horror.
And she finds out she's the new gatekeeper.
There are scary, scary people with totally white eyes.
That crazy scene where the supermodel is walking through with one shoulder down.
Oh! Scary as hell. Scary as hell.
Doesn't even look.
You don't even know what's going on. Was that her dad? Was that some freaky guy? Did she build a robot and forgot about it?
What do you want from me? Who are you?
Okay, well, let's move on from there.
Well, first we should give this this film a rating for the people so they know what to think.
Yes.
Let's tell them a little bit about how we're going to rate movies on this show.
Okay. Well, we've got three different ratings for our movies.
The first one, the best movies, are going to be sent directly to Cinematic Heaven. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200 because you don't need it. You're in heaven.
Mm-hmm. We got Purgatory of Lost Films.
You know, these films, you could rent them, you could see them if they're on TV, but, you know, you don't have to.
And then, of course, Damnation.
Yeah, don't see this film. It's bad. It will hurt you. It will probably hurt your loved ones as well.
We've probably put a little caveat on the Damnation one. If you like going to hell...
Yeah, then this may be for you. I mean, some films are definitely damnable that are still worth watching. We're not saying that they're not worth watching. We're just saying maybe they shouldn't have been made.
Right. There we go. So what are you giving The Sentinel?
I am sending The Sentinel directly to Cinematic Heaven. This is one of my favorite supernatural films. It has a great atmosphere. All around, great film.
I agree for the most part. I'm probably going to go with Purgatory on this one, though. Even though I enjoyed the film, there were some parts of it I thought that were... just didn't flow. But it's definitely worth checking out. So with being in the Purgatory of Lost Films, rent it. Put it on your next Netflix queue. Definitely check it out.
And this is one we should mention that you can watch on Netflix. Watch it now, which is great.
Yes.
I love that. I think, you know, people should do more of that because it's the wave of the future anyway. So, you know, get on it, watch it on your computer, and it's definitely worth your time.
Okay.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break here, and we'll be back with another review.
I got nothing more on that incident in the mine yesterday. It looks like some guy just went wacko.
It happens here.
How often?
I don't know. It just happens here.
Why?
I'm not a psychiatrist. I can't tell you why. Some people just can't take it here after a while.
What's that guy think he's doing?
No way it could have been homicide. Had to have been a suicide.
28 in the last 6 months.
Did you do autopsy?
No.
Then how do you know it was a suicide?
There's no other explanation.
When a person exposes himself to zero pressure atmosphere, there isn't a whole lot left to inspect.
Something's there, isn't it?
Maybe.
Try and meddle, I want you to know what you're meddling with. How do you leave?
I'm
dealing with grown-ups here.
Bingo.
Marshall, you're dead.
If you're the kind of guy you're supposed to be, you wouldn't stick around. That's why they sent you here.
Maybe they made a mistake.
Outland, the ultimate enemy, is still man.
You just heard the trailer for the 1981 film Outland, starring Sean Connery.
Yes, indeed. Sean Connery playing Marshal W.T. O'Neill. And he's just been assigned to the mining colony Io, one of Jupiter's moons. During his tenure, miners are dying, usually violently. When the Marshal investigates, he discovers the one thing all the deaths have in common is a lethal amphetamine-type drug, which allows the miners to work continuously for days at a time until they become burned out and expire. O'Neill follows the trail of the dealers, which leads to the man overseeing the colony. Now O'Neill must watch his back at every turn as those who seek to protect their income begin targeting him.
High noon in outer space.
It is. It is indeed High Noon in Outer Space, and a pretty good reversion of it as well.
Now, I don't know if we talked about this before. Had you seen this prior?
No, I haven't. As big a Sean Connery fan as I am, I had somehow missed out on this one for many, many years. I've known about it, and I've never had a chance to see it.
I had not either. And damn, if I'm glad that I did.
Yeah, me too. It's pretty good.
I enjoyed it quite a bit. I already like westerns. I'm not a huge science fiction fan. I do like. How should I say this? Probably the cheesier the better when it comes to sci-fi for me.
Right. So you like your Star Crash?
Right. Flash Gordon. Maybe
some ice pirates.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, there we go.
Now and this one isn't really, as far as like science fiction movies go, this is actually, how should I put it? It's like, that's kind of like the way I actually see the future happening. It's like of people mining on other planets and space stations and all that.
Right. Other than the technological kind of step down that a lot of the computers and whatnot in the film.
Oh, I know.
Other than that, you know, a lot of it seems definitely, you know, right on to how things could go down with people mining planets in the future. I mean, it sounds very feasible and it looks pretty realistic. I mean, the effects are pretty good. All the exteriors look pretty good and everything. And I really like it. Now, there are some things in it that are a little odd, but, you know, for the most part, yeah, it does strike a very good realistic feel in the film.
Yeah, it should probably be noted that although it came out in the era of the Alien knockoff, there's actually no aliens in the film.
No, but it definitely kind of has a similar feeling. Just some of the, you know, costuming and whatnot, kind of the jumpsuits, and everybody's wearing like a trucker hat with like an emblem on it. It kind of just had a similar kind of vibe to Aliens and whatnot, although far be it on a much less grand scale.
I think that's one of the reasons that I avoided it for so long is because I was under the impression that it was another one of those Alien knockoff movies that came out in the early 80s.
Well, it didn't help that they put the tagline on it, even in space, the ultimate enemy is man. Which, you know, clearly they were trying to play off of the Alien connection.
Right.
But, you know, it's got a lot going for it. Sean Connery can be very hit and miss. You know, when he hits, you get, you know, some of his stronger James Bond movies. And when he misses, you get Zardos.
Oh, man. Now, I actually kind of like that because that goes into that cheesy factor.
I do too, but it's not one of his better acting performances.
Certainly not.
But it is a pretty fun film on its own. One of the most interesting things I think about this film is, again, for the second time in a row with another film, we have some interesting casting going on here, and a lot of people, familiar faces, people will recognize, and I think that's another strong part of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We got Peter Boyle.
Which everybody knows from Everybody Loves Raymond now.
Right.
He's my father-in-law.
That's good.
Yeah, that's my Raymond. Enjoy it, or don't.
But I'm a huge Peter Boyle fan. I think he was phenomenal. Yeah.
He definitely was. I mean, hardcore. He's great in that. He's of course great in Young Frankenstein. He has a lot of really fine roles.
Did you ever happen to see the movie Joe?
No, I've not seen that.
That's early 70s, kind of a vigilante film. Picture Archie Bunker becomes a vigilante.
Nice.
Yeah, it's nice. good flick. But yeah, Peter Boyle's in it. Francis Sternhagen,
right? Who's... And oddly enough, John Ratzenberger too.
Yes.
And so John Ratzenberger, everybody knows as Cliff. Mm-hmm. Francis Steenhagen, everybody will know as Cliff's mom, from Cheers.
Yeah.
So kind of strange that the two of them are both in this movie several years before.
Connery is really good in this one, I thought.
He really is. He gives a very emotional performance. I think it's a very kind of raw performance. And definitely, you can tell he's watched High Noon a few times.
was going to say, he had to know he was filling Gary Cooper's shoes. So,
yeah, and I think he definitely strikes a similar kind of tone that Cooper struck with his character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the part where, and I don't know how many people out there has actually seen High Noon or even know what it's about, but it's basically Sheriff comes to this new town, and basically he's got to confront these guys, and the town kind of all turns their back on him, and he's got to stand alone against these guys. And it's kind of a similar situation in this one, where all the people, all the other miners and stuff don't, they know that this bad stuff's about to happen. I'm trying not to give too much away, but, and he's like, at one point, one of the guys is like, you know, you're supposed to be protecting us. You know, where are your people at? Meaning the rest of the police force.
He's right. Like, and you get the great line, my people are shit.
Yeah. Loved it.
Yeah, it was great. It was great delivery, and he's got great delivery on a lot of lines. The scenes with him and Peter Boyle are stellar. Peter Boyle's character, the evil operator of the mine, seems to always be playing golf in his office, and they have a few interchanges over some golf swings, and it's good stuff. I mean, there's definitely, you know, sparks fly between the two of them.
What I loved about Boyle, well, probably both of them in those scenes for them together, it was like totally deadpan. Right. Like they could, like Boyle could have been like this over the top villain, but they both talk to each other very chummy.
Yeah, it's very congenial. Like, I hate your guts, you hate my guts, but you know, it'll work itself out.
Yeah, very good. If not, I mean, it's a little odd, but odd doesn't necessarily mean bad. Their connection is a very odd one.
It is. One of the most interesting things about this scene, especially since it's supposed to be in the future, is that Boyle plays like a golf video game, where he's like hitting a ball towards a screen that's an actual shot of a golf course, and then the ball will fly through the air. I totally remember that game being out in arcades.
Yeah.
And like, around the same time as this movie came out, so the big futuristic thing was just down the street. You could play it for a couple quarters.
I'm a precursor to the Nintendo Wii.
Yeah, in a way, it definitely was.
Another scene that pretty much from that point on, it had me. Probably the most badass thing. It's up there, man. If I made a top 10 list of the most badass things I've ever seen of a character do in a film, when Connery is chasing that guy through the I don't know what you'd call it, the base, mm-hmm. and if the guy's got the drugs on him and he's chasing him, mm-hmm. and the guy throws the drugs into the boiling pot of water, right. And Connery could. Because he knows he needs these drugs for the proof, and he just reaches his hand into the boiling water, feels around for it.
Right. Like, I'll kick your ass in a minute. I gotta get these drugs first out of this boiling pot of water.
He puts his hand in the boiling water.
I know. I mean, it's just definitely the sign of a complete and total badass.
Right, exactly.
Not that there was any question about that at all. Now, I do have to mention, keeping on the facial hair theme that we've had running through this movie, the amount of amazing beards in this movie.
Right, yep.
Apparently, in the future, beards are in a big, big way. So, Sean Connery, Peter Boyle, James Syking, they have all got just massive, massive beards going on. And it's definitely the scenes between Connery and Boyle. It's you know, they'd be more tense, but their beards are keeping them further apart.
Right. Yep. There was definitely a lot of facial hair in this film.
No doubt.
Another thing I was, because this is basically a reimagining of High Noon, the story itself, and I was thinking this through the whole thing. The story itself, if you took the story, which is basically just a crime movie, you know, put in space. If you took it and put it into a contemporary setting with, like, Connor is just a normal, cop, and it takes place in some small mining town, it would be a really dull movie. But put it in outer space, or put it in the Old West.
Yeah, then you got something.
That's amazing how you can take something so, like, mundane and, like, not that interesting. It would be an okay movie, maybe like a TV movie or something like that, but... Yeah, put it in outer space with Sean Connery, or in the West with Gary Cooper, then you got gold.
Well, I think what works in both of the movies, and what makes kind of a mundane story really pop, is that both the small mining town in High Noon and the space station are so isolated. I mean, High Noon all revolves around the arrival of a train that comes through. While Outland revolves around the arrival of a shuttle that only comes once a week. I think the isolation is what works, and that's why if you took the same story and put it in a city, it loses something. Because it would be hard now to even set it in a mining city somewhere in modern times and go like, oh, it's isolated. I mean, maybe an Alaskan mining town or something like that. Somewhere you could see Russia from your porch.
Basically, it would be an episode of Law and Order or CSI or something like that.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, Ice-T could show up at any time. He might.
Now, that would have been something.
It would have. If Ice-T had just shown up in here, I would have been like, oh, this is the best movie ever.
I was checking the figures on this. Now, when this first came out, I guess I wouldn't have called it a bomb, but it certainly wasn't a hit.
I wouldn't imagine it would have gone over huge.
It didn't make a whole lot of its money back. Especially not in its open weekend. That's probably a lot of reason why I never even heard of it until like a few years ago.
Right. I mean, the only reason it was on my radar at all is I'm a huge Bond fan. So for years, it's one I've heard of. I can see why it wouldn't have gone over, because in 81, I mean, Star Wars was in full swing. People were churning out science fiction movies left and right. And here comes this one with, you know, Sean Connery, who has kind of fallen from grace. He's no longer Bond. I don't think they had made Never Say Never Again yet. It's kind of like Sean in the middle of not really being a star. And then Peter Boyle, who's a great actor, but, I mean, he's not exactly a box office draw.
Right. Everybody's
ever been like, yeah, let's go down and see that Peter Boyle movie.
Right.
And it really is a slow character piece. It's the action comes in at the end, but for the first hour or so, I mean, you're pretty much talking with some occasional fights and whatnot, but mostly building up the characters.
It was directed by Peter Hyams, who, I don't know if you looked into his filmography or not. He did 2010. He did Running Scared. I don't know if you ever saw that with Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines.
Right. And The Presidio with, Sean again.
That Stay Tuned with John Ritter.
Oh, what a horrible piece of shit that movie that is.
Which is good, bring it. And then he did a couple of Jean-Claude Van Damme movies.
Well, yeah, he did Time Cop. One of the best. I mean, that's one of the cream of the crop Van Damme movies there.
This is the point that I'm getting at, is that Peter Hyams obviously makes really well-made schlock.
He does. I mean, I think he's also pretty well-known for Capricorn 1.
Yes.
Which is, one of my wife's favorite movies, haha. And she enjoys that film. And actually, there's a little Capricorn 1 nod in here. The mining company is called Con Amalgamate.
Yeah, I caught that.
And that's the same company that made the defective life support system in Capricorn 1. So that's kind of cool that he linked the two together in that way.
Yeah, Yeah, so it's his films, from a technical standpoint, they all look good. If you were to turn the volume down and just look at them, so you'd be like, wow, this looks really good.
Right. The scripts he works from and the material itself occasionally leaves something to be desired.
Right.
But I don't think that was the case this time.
No. This... Because before I watched it, I was like, because I didn't know hardly anything about it. So I kind of looked up a few things and I saw that it was Peter Hyams and I was like, But yeah, I was amazed. But by the last, the last act of the film, I was on the edge of my seat. I was like, I was into it.
Yeah, me too. I mean, the action sequence at the end, it's almost about 20, 30 minutes almost of solid action. And it really gets your heart racing. It's pretty exciting.
Probably a geek alert addition here I should tack on is Outland was the first motion picture to use IntroVision.
Ooh.
A variation of front projection that allows foreground, midground, and background elements to be combined in a camera as opposed to using the optical processes like blue screen.
Right.
So enables characters to convincingly walk around miniature sets, which I thought even for 1981, there was some of it that looked a little cheesy, but for the most part, I thought it was the special effects were pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, you didn't see, the very obvious lines that you get on the special effects, on the inserts and lower budget productions. So yeah, I thought they came off very good. I mean, especially once you get into the movie itself, it's barely noticeable that there's kind of effect shots going on.
I thought there were some liberal uses of the law of gravity.
Yeah, a little bit. Well, it was 1/6 Earth gravity. They were very they were wanting to make sure we knew that for some reason. Very important. It's 1/6.
Right.
Which I did my division to work out what that was, and I have no fucking idea. So I just wanted to let you know that I worked on it. And I still don't know.
Well, it's enough for things to fall at quite an incredible rate.
It is.
That was the only things that probably took me out of it a little bit, because I'm just going, now wait a minute.
Yeah, I know what you mean. There were those moments, but again, it is an action movie at its heart, and it's an action movie from the 80s, and things like that can kind of be forgiven.
Yeah, I'm not a stickler for those kind of things. Those are the kind of things I can forgive.
Yeah, that's for the nitpickers to, oh, you couldn't do that.
Now, if the movie had sucked, I definitely would have thrown it in as a complaint, though.
Oh, yeah, I would have been like, this movie sucked balls and the gravity stuff was insane. But since I liked it, I'm going to be like, it's fine.
Yeah. It's got Sean Connery in it.
It's got Sean Connery. Now, on a geek note myself, I've got a geek thing I want to add in here.
Mm-hmm.
Another connection between our two movies tonight. James Sykin, who is Sean Connery's second in command when he takes over as the marshal. A lot of people will know him as Doogie Howser's dad from 88 episodes of Doogie Howser. Yeah, blew on your mind.
See, the whole time I'm going, where do I know that guy from?
Right. Well, one place I know him from that's not Doogie Howser is Star Trek III, where he has a small part as Captain Stiles. Now, if you're not a Trekkie, whatnot, too bad. I fucking am. So you're going to have to listen to this piece of trivia. In the Sentinel, at the very, very end, there's a quick cameo. One of the people is Tom Berenger, and the other character is played by Nana Visitor, who was on Star Trek Deep Space Nine. So there's a Star Trek connection that runs through this, and I kind of have an idea that in almost every genre movie you could watch, somebody will have been in Star Trek.
6 degrees of Star Trek.
Yeah, it's usually more like one. It seems like, but I thought that was kind of an interesting little connection between these two films.
Yeah, well, overall, quite an enjoyable film.
Well, why don't you put a rating on this bad mofo?
This one for me is definitely cinematic heaven. I didn't think I would like it that much because, like I said, I'm not huge into science fiction. But this one, with Connery being a badass and the fact that it's not, how should I put it? Not that I have anything against movies with aliens and stuff like that, but it's the realistic aspect of the film I enjoyed personally. So yeah, definitely cinematic heaven. It's a must see for me.
Yeah, you know, I gotta say it's cinematic heaven for me too. Sean Connery, so good. The movie in general, really entertaining. This is one that more people should see. So get out there and definitely check this one out.
Yes. All right. Well, should we move on then?
Yeah, let's move on. Let's let people hear a little sweet selection of music from Violent Naples. And we're back. Now, how'd you like that? That's some fun stuff.
I need a pizza.
Yeah, who doesn't? I don't know what that means, but...
I don't either.
It doesn't matter. Either way, a great piece of music. So, we're talking Violent Naples from 1976. Rev, tell me a little bit about what this is about.
Well, kind of a fast-paced crime thriller with Maurizio Merli as Commissioner Betty. I was trying to say the Italian version of Commissioner, but it just wasn't happening.
Yeah, that's all right.
Basically, this is, I mean, I'm just going to go ahead and say it. This is basically a Dirty Harry ripoff. Not completely. It's along those kind of lines.
Definitely inspired by.
Certainly, and basically he's a badass cop that is trying to stop a racketeering scheme, and it's directed by Umberto Lenzi, and there's a lot of violence, and it's magnificent.
It definitely is, and that's why this one definitely deserves to be one of our bizarre treasures.
Yes.
Which, of course, you can get by going to Cinema de Bazaar. That's cinema-de-bazaar.com.
And along with being directed by Umberto Lenzi, the guy from that did Cannibal Ferox, Nightmare City, Eaten Alive, the cannibal Eaten Alive, not the Toby Hooper
Eaten Alive. Not the giant crocodile Eaten Alive. That's not right. What we're talking about.
So he brings... So if you're familiar with those films, he brings that to a cop flick, which
is kind of amazing. I mean, Lindsay, you know, everybody knows him for the horror films, but I mean, he came in right here. This is actually the middle part of a trilogy of films that starts off with Violent Rome, and ends with a film called A Special Cop in Action that all have Commissioner Betty in it. And Lindsay only directed this middle part here. Mm-hmm. You know, he came in and there's a striking difference between this movie and Violent Rome, which was directed by Marino Giolami or something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Violent Rome was very kind of stock action-y. Kind of film. I mean,
slow.
It's slow. Yeah, definitely slow. Merli was very charismatic. It had Richard Conte and John Steiner and Ray Lovelock. So it had a lot of good people in it, but it just kind of, it was there. It was a good introduction to the character, but it just didn't ever get off the ground. With Violent Naples, I think they definitely got off the ground.
Yes. So obviously Lindsay's touch to the film added a lot. Because with now he's got his horror, you know, extreme like exploitation type stuff, but then he also did a lot of crime films as well. Syndicate Sadists, Almost Human, I'm blanking on some other ones. I think he did Spasmo.
Yes.
So yeah, he brought that in with him, added the horror element with like the gore, because it's a really violent film.
Oh, it's an extremely violent film. You get an impalement on a fence. Mm-hmm. You get an incredible scene with a trolley car that just kind of was shocking to see.
Shocking, definitely. And I don't shock easily.
No, but I mean, you're watching a Polizia film. I mean, you're not expecting to see, you know, incredible gore jumping out at you, but expect it when Lindsay is behind the camera.
Right. Well, what I was getting at there was that his Polizia films were definitely where he shined the most, I think. Even though I'm a huge fan of Cannibal Ferox and Eaten Alive, but from a technical standpoint, as a director, this was some of his best work.
Right. Yeah, I definitely agree with that as well. It's a really strong film, and I think, you know, the only thing that kind of holds it back is Marley. I mean, I like the guy, but I mean, he's kind of like a cut rate version of Franco Nero.
Yeah, his performance is kind of one of those place your actor here kind of roles,
right.
Cut out kind of a lot. Anybody could have played the role. I mean, not to knock him too much, because I've actually seen him in some other things,
mm-hmm.
Where he's a hell of a lot better than he was in this. So I don't know if that's because he knew, because I've actually read a couple places, he actually knew that he was the go-to Franco Nero guy. It's like,
right.
If we can't get Franco Nero, well, we'll just use Merle.
Right. He looks just like him. I mean, look, giant mustache.
Right. It might have been Violent Rome where when I believe they wanted Nero.
Right.
And they're like, well, no, can't get Nero. By that time, he was asking too much. And they were like, oh, we know this guy, Merle. So yeah.
He's similar.
Right.
Just get him. But, you know, even though Merle's, you know, just kind of passable here, I mean, we've still got John Saxon.
John motherfucking Saxon.
That is correct. The Saxon. And that's all there is to it. I mean, there's not a time that I don't like to see John Saxon show up in a film. If he could just be in everything, that would be fine.
Sure, he could just pop in, you know, and grimace and leave.
Yeah, just pop in, look a little balding, look, you know, uncomfortable, and be like, and just be out of there.
Because then you could at least say, that movie sucked, but John Saxon was in it.
Exactly. I mean, everything's better with a little Saxon. That's all I'm saying. And this film definitely, you know, gets some of that. I mean, the scenes that he's in are definitely caught my attention just because he was on the screen.
Yeah, it could have benefited a hell of a lot more from more Saxon time.
Sure, definitely. You get a couple other familiar faces in here. You get Barry Sullivan showing up, American actor, another American actor showing up for an Italian film because he had nothing better to do.
A lot of those. Oh, that guy. That's yes. I know that guy.
Yes, exactly. You know him. You know, that guy. Of course, Sullivan, probably most known for Italian films, for appearing in Planet of the Vampires.
Mm-hmm.
The very strange Mario Bava space vampire film.
Right. Very strange.
Yeah, that's definitely, that might be something that you'll hear about more on this show in the future.
If I could make it all the way through it.
Uh-oh.
I've tried 2 times to make it all the way through that movie, and I've not succeeded.
Uh-oh. Well, we'll have to see what we can do about that. I'll try to prop you up with. I'll send you a bunch of coffee and be like, "Come on, get it done." Because I kind of like that one myself.
And you know, I'm not completely knocking it. It's just, it's kind of one of those movies, and this happens a lot. I can only speak for myself, where it's like you just got to kind of be in the right frame of mind to watch certain kind of movies.
It's definitely not your typical Bava piece. It's definitely something that if you're going for a Bava movie, don't pick it first.
Certainly, yes.
But we're completely off the rails here. Let's get this back on track.
We opened with the score, a little sampling of the score. That's from Franco Michelizzi, who that's probably one of my favorite, because if you're anybody's out there is familiar with these kind of films, these Polizia films, the score for these films are usually pretty fucking awesome if you like that kind of music.
Yeah, definitely. And I know I have a couple of selections from this movie on a CD of Polizia music, and if they come on while I'm in the car, I definitely have to watch my speed, because I'll start thinking I'm in a Fiat and that I'm going to go bust up some drug dealers and maybe just punch a guy and like grow a bigger mustache, and you know, I just got to rein it back and be like, no, it's okay, you're just driving.
Now, usually, two of the bigger names in for the music for these films are the De Angelis brothers, yes, and Ennio Morricone.
Right.
But Franco Michelizzi, that's he kind of a little bit more of an obscure one. But he brings his A game to this one. That is just such an... we were talking about this earlier, kind of like a jazz rock infused with Italian folk music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, three great tastes that takes great together? I'd have to say so. I mean, it is a really great score, even though it is just a weird pastiche of stuff.
It's like as soon as that comes on, that's the opening credits, and as soon as that kicks in, you're like, yeah!
Yeah, no doubt. It definitely sets the film off with the right tone.
Right.
And I think that's something that really makes the movie pop right up front, because it doesn't get right into it. There's a build before there's any real good action. So since they're not front loading it with an action piece, you know, front loading it with that really kind of driving action sounding score really, you know, captured my attention.
And I almost wonder, because it's so stereotypically Italian sounding, like da 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 kind of a thing, that I almost wonder if Italian audiences kind of like rolled their eyes.
Apparently, that song is called Folk and Violence.
There you go.
Which, you know, talk about two things that go together. if only some more folk musicians would put a little more violence into their music, I think we could all get behind that.
That's like saying a polka mosh pit.
Yes, exactly. Which, you know, I'm sure is out there somewhere. If you know of a polka mosh pit, please let us know. This is something we have to know about.
I'm sure a lot of beer would be involved in that, I'm sure. So,
I imagine.
All right. Well, I think we've pretty much covered as much as we can on that one.
Yeah, I think so. I think that pretty much wraps it up. And this is another film you can get from Cinema de Bazaar, which, of course, both the Rev and I love to pieces. That's a great place to go for all your hard to find cult and exploitation films. They got so much stuff. Just sifting through their catalog, taking an afternoon to look to see what they got is just a blast in itself.
That is true. I've spent many an hour at their website just looking through stuff.
Yeah, definitely, me too. So go over there, check them out, tell them the boys over at Sinful Cinema have sent you. And pretty soon we'll be offering a discount code for Cinema de Bazaar, so keep your ears open for that in the future.
Ooh.
Oh, no, fancy. I think that about wraps it up for Sinful Cinema this week. But tell me, Rev, what have you got going on for your blog this week?
Well, This is my third annual Blaxploitation Month.
Oh yeah, I've been loving it. That live review of the Mac you put up earlier was the bomb.
So yeah, I got more of that in store. I for my live reviews, I believe I'm trying to do Coffee,
nice.
And Truck Turner for my next two live reviews.
Nice. Well, coming up this week, of course, that's at ReverendPhantom.com. You want to go to check out Midnight Confessions. Over at the LightningBugsLair.com, this week I'm going to have a little dinner with a vampire.
Ooh.
Oh yeah, I know it's going to be nice. It's a little Lumberto Bava, probably best known for Demons, but we'll see how bad this one is. And I'm going to visit a little more Richard Franklin, a director that I can't get enough of. After Patrick and Rogue Games, I'm still looking to see what he's been up to. So I'm looking at his last film this week, 2003's Visitors with Rhoda Mitchell, who some people know from Silent Hill.
Nice.
Yeah, it should be a good time. And of course, this weekend I'll have another installment of Love, the Larrikin Style, where I'm celebrating romance over at the Lightning Bugs Lair in honor of Valentine's and the month of Valentine's.
Oh, you big softy.
I know, I really am. But, you know, just because I'm a big softy doesn't mean that these are going to be your regular romantic films. So check me out on Saturday to see what that's going to be all about.
Sounds good. All right.
All right. And so until next week, everybody, we'd love to hear what you have to say. You can send your feedback to us at sinfulcinema@charter.net. And we'd love to hear what you say. We'll read your emails out in the show and respond to you and whatnot. And until then, for the Rev and TL Bug, keep sinning.
Later, y'all.